Here's a song called Cut Loose Shaker.
Martha here. It seems to me somehow appropriate to call Jimmy O the Energizer Bunny of working musicians around these parts, in that he just keeps going and going and going. I met the talented Mr. O way, way back in the 1980s when he and his band at the time, Jimmy O and the Ready Teds, were playing rockabilly dance music at the wondrous and sadly no longer extant C&O Club in Charlottesville. And I defy you to listen to the following sample of his music from those days and not dance, or at least tap your toes.
If you ain't ready to rock, don't mess with me. I got my motor on, it's plain to see. We're gonna cut loose, shake it. It's early, I know. Gonna cut loose, shake it. Don't move too slow. Well, come on.
Where'd you grow up?
Ada, Oklahoma, a little town in south central Oklahoma.
I know Ada,
the
Oklahoma.
Center of the universe. I was the youngest of a very musical family, Martha, and we were all two older brothers and mom and dad, and everybody played and sang. And
Mama sang bass,
yeah,
right?
It was just kind of a normal thing that as we were growing up, we were all expected to play a stringed instrument, play the piano, and a brass instrument. And by the time I came along, being the youngest, all the brass instruments had been selected except for trombone. So I was kind of stuck with trombone because that was the missing, you know, piece in the family band. I'll never forget learning I was actually too small. The seventh position in the slide trombone was too far. Once I got it down there, I couldn't reach it to pull it back. So I'd always lose a bar, so kicking it back up with the end of my foot.
And when you say you had a musical family.
My dad was a Salvation Army officer. A third generation in our family. And so, as you may or may not know, the brass bands and the music and everything,
absolutely.
big part of the whole program. And so that, right from the beginning, we were learning music and singing and being pushed up in front of people at church and in the city and at family gatherings and stuff. So that all came very naturally. His particular talent was raising money for like new buildings and new programs and things like that. And so every few years, he was being asked to go somewhere where there was a problem to kind of help fix it.
Uh-huh.
And so we lived in Oklahoma, and then back around 1971, he was asked to come to Richmond to help the program there. And Richmond in 1970 was a little bit different than Oklahoma, population of 10,000 people, this town where we've been living. So when he finished his work there for the first time in his career, he said, you know, can you send me somewhere else? We're really a little out of place here. And the guy who had been the Salvation Army officer in Charlottesville was leaving. And they said, well, there's this position in Charlottesville. And he said, yeah, that sounds great. So we came to Charlottesville, and that's where I stayed.
How old were you when you came to Seville?
I was a junior in high school.
Okay, so you were really...
Early 70s.
Yeah, really ready to... Ooh, I remember those. Well, when I first saw you... Didn't meet you, saw you, and went, wow. You were up there on the stage at the old C&O dance club, and I was dancing my toes off.
Glory days.
Was it Jimmy O and the Something? I just remember Jimmy O.
We had my first band. I began my career in the spring of 1977. I was living in an old ramshackle, crumbling Victorian house in the University Corner University of Virginia.
Oh, know
Corner
it well.
District. And I was a 20-year-old kid. Just as footloose as could possibly be. And I was living in this big house kind of communally with a bunch of artist, student, bohemian, beatnik, hippie types and needed very little money to get by.
Yeah.
And had always had this dream of, you know, playing music. And I just kind of began asking people, can I just come and sit in the corner and with my guitar? And I had no equipment. I had no song list. I knew nothing. And so eventually I got into my first group, and we were universally the worst band in town. I mean, ask anybody. But it was a learning curve.
What was the name?
It was a group called Dodge, D'ART. Dodge D'Art.
Dodge D'Art. I remember Dodge
D'Art. Dodge D'Art.
Yes.
Waiting your hand, and you know it's all.
Well, the cool thing about it was that we didn't know that we weren't supposed to be doing certain things, so we didn't know not to do it. And so we were just like a bull in the china shop. We were just out. We didn't care. We didn't care if we made any money. We didn't care if there was anyone in the audience. We just wanted to play, right? And it was interesting because we were really crummy and out of tune, and our equipment was really cheap and falling apart. It was horrible. But oddly enough, that group was from 1978 till about 1980. Right about then, suddenly it was the Clash and the Sex Pistols and groups like that. And it was kind of cool to be out of tune and, you know, kind of rough, you know, kind of sound not that great. And people started to like us. And we thought, what happened? You know, we've been the lousiest band in town for years. And now all of a sudden people are like, wow, you guys are pretty cool.
You were just ahead of the curve. Well, weren't you?
And like other bands that don't know any better, when we started to get successful, we broke up. I didn't have an idea for a second band. There was a girl that we knew that had been living in Holland. And this is like 1981. And she had become a fan. And she came around. She said, you know, there's an American group in Europe that's really just going like barnstorming Europe. And I can't believe nobody in this country has heard of them yet. And she had an album. That's a big record, Little Hole in the Middle. You know,
I remember that.
You had to flip it over to hear the other side. Yeah. And it was the Stray Cats. And she said, you know, people are just going crazy over this American kind of rockabilly thing. And I thought, well, that's, you know, look at them. They look cool. And, you know, this is kind of a new yet kind of retro.
Yeah.
You know, I really like what's going on here. And so I got another three guys together with me, and we basically learned that album. And then about 6 months later, and no one was paying any attention, 6 months later, MTV broke. And the Stray Cats were like one of the first artists to be featured regularly on MTV. And we were the only band out there that looked and sounded that way. And suddenly it was a very successful group.
I said, come on, baby, let's get ready to go.
Have you sort of stuck with rockabilly?
Well, there's always been an amount of that, a certain element of that in what I do.
Yeah.
What I do now, my motto, as I say on the website, jimmyovirginia.com, is preserve endangered music. And so I go from like 1955 to about 1985. That's what I do. Everything within that context, pop, soul, blues, rock and roll, folk, everything. It's just kind of like a little slice of pop music history within that 30-year period that I do.
I can't think of another musician that I remember back from my Elliewood Avenue days who has kept going. Kept you going?
I love my work. I've done it so long now that it's really, I don't know what life would be like. I mean, I've done it for 35 years, Martha. Like anyone else, there are nights that I have at work where I kind of wish I was at home walking the dog and going to bed at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't happen. Aside from that, and that doesn't happen very often, thankfully, but it doesn't matter if there's 5 or 5,000 in front of me. If I see somehow or another that those people are being entertained, that something that I'm doing is resonating with the audience and they're interested in what I'm doing and enjoying it, then I feel like it's the correct application of whatever limited abilities I have. I'm applying those where I should in life. And that is really gratifying.
And rare, I think, for people to feel that kind of satisfaction and centeredness when they're working.
Yeah, and once again, it doesn't matter how many or how few. You know, if I have that feeling at some point, and it's an elusive thing. Sometimes it happens right away all night long, and sometimes it's kind of there, and then it slips away, and it kind of comes back, and then, you know, and sometimes it doesn't happen until the very end of the night, and sometimes it happens early and then goes away for a while. I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. I love that part of it. Songs are like a toolbox. You know, there are certain songs in that toolbox that will do a certain thing for you. And I like standing in front of a room before I begin kind of looking, assessing what the prevailing atmosphere is. What should I be doing here tonight? And then you pull a song or two out, and maybe it works, and then maybe it doesn't. Let me try something else. And eventually, that's it. And you just kind of ride that wave, you know, for a while. So I like that.
I cannot imagine the self-discipline it must take to keep an entertainment career going. First of all, you got to stay physically in good shape. Am I right in that? Is there a lot of self-discipline involved here?
The thing where I am now is I've always been self-managed and I've always acted as my own agent. And so aside from simply the performance part of it, there's the organization of the job, bookings and making sure that certain things happen and that you've... So my schedule is usually telescoped out about a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm scheduling next April and May right now. And a lot of those are engagements that happen either weekly or monthly. So it's not terribly complicated, but it's something that has to be maintained. I mean, you have to stay right on top of it because people in management positions with whom I've worked for years sometimes come and go very abruptly.
Yes.
You know, so you've got, you know, all of a sudden this relationship that you've cultivated with a venue for ages, there's somebody new in there and you've got to kind of start all over. And it's, it's challenging. The audience is, it's interesting how they've changed over the years because there's been a drastic change in the audience.
How?
Well, when I first began playing, within a short period of time, thankfully, I started to see certain people that were there, you know, gaining a following or something, I guess you'd say. And that was very rewarding. And they seemed to be enjoying what I was doing. And if I was playing somewhere, for instance, every Thursday night, I'd see these same group of people every Thursday and got to know them. And right away, they would come out. If I was playing anything remotely like the same song list from last Thursday, this is back in the late 70s up to through the mid 80s, I'd hear about it right away. You know, Jimmy, this is the same, you know, come on, man, shuffle the deck a little bit. You know, this is the same music we heard last week when you were in here. So because of that, I was forced to learn a lot of music. I mean, on a daily basis, I was working 10, 15, 20 songs onto the list because the audience demanded that it be something different from performance to performance. Now, Martha, 35 years later, and this is not a criticism, it's shifted all the way to the other end of the spectrum. People want to hear the same songs from the last time around. And if you start trailing off from a certain song list, they'll come up. Jimmy, what is this?
I was listening to John Fogerty's cover of Garden Party, the old Rick Nelson song,
right.
You know, if memories were all I sang, I'd rather drive a truck.
Right.
You ever feel like that?
A little bit. Well, there's certain songs that it would be perfectly fine with me if I never sang again as long as I lived, or if they just disappeared from the face of the earth for that matter. But, you know, I kind of look at it philosophically. It's 3.5 minutes of my life. You know, and it's not a bad piece of music. The only problem with it is that it's just been around too consistently. It needs to go away for about 20 years and come back.
Have you maintained a voice performing on this brutal schedule for 35 years?
Well, it's interesting because when I'd been singing all my life.
Mm-hmm.
So when I made that step to singing professionally, I thought, well, I've been singing for hours a day since I could talk. And so this won't be a problem. But I'd never sung in that environment before. I'd never been forced to sing as loudly or as late in the night or in these smoke-filled rooms from time to time and things like that. There was myself and another singer that were splitting the singing in my first group. We were losing our voices. And as time went by, we found there were certain songs that we just couldn't sing any longer. So in a rare flash of illumination at that point in our lives, we thought we must be doing something wrong. And so this was in Charlottesville, and we asked around in the music department there about, you know, we have this problem, what should we do? And someone eventually referred us to Carl Beard, who was the choir director at the University Baptist Church in Charlottesville, gifted singer. And he took mercy on us and brought us in to give us vocal training. I've been singing all my life, but no one had ever taught me to sing. And for about a year, twice a week, we'd go la 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 la. You went through
the whole thing,
and it saved my voice. If I hadn't done that in the very, very beginning, there's no question that I wouldn't have a voice today. Because even now, years later, in crunch times, very, very busy periods of the year for me, where I might do 10 or 12 engagements in a week.
Oh my goodness.
Your voice gets stressed out, and you have to take a vow of silence for a couple of days, you know, that kind of thing.
It'd be hard.
Well, it is. And there's a lot of talking that happens at a performance also, before the show, but when you're on a break, after the show. I call it the meets and greets, you know, with the audience.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people that come out for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll enjoy the music also, but that trip over to the table to say hello to them and meet their friends and chit-chat with them for 5 minutes, that's just as important. But rock and roll singing particularly breaks all the rules of how one is supposed to sing. And the older you get, the more, you know, wear and tear that your voice has sustained over the years. So it becomes an even greater issue as time goes by.
Estamos en Cuba libre, la tierra del sol, el sueño de mi vida, lo magnífico. Me encanta ese lugar feliz.
Hopefully, you now feel somewhat acquainted with musician Jimmy O, who's been entertaining us around WMRA land and parts beyond for over three decades. The music playing beneath me, however, was written and performed by filmmaker James Overton as part of the score for his latest movie, Patriots. Back in a moment to talk film with Mr. Overton.
La tierra de mi padre y mi abuelo también. Deseo una Cuba libre, cantar esta canción.
Ay, 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 ay.
Canto, canto.
Ay, ay, ay.
Siempre y siempre.
Ay, ay, ay.
Oh, yeah.
Ay, ay, ay.
Estamos en una Cuba libre, la tierra del sol.
Okay, so you've been earning your living as a musician for over 30 years. And then one day you realize you have an unscratched itch to make films and you decide to just do it, if I may borrow Nike's phrase. As that kind of describes the recent doings of musician Jimmy O, a.k.a. James Overton filmmaker, I, of course, had to ask him why.
You know, I had some friends as my music career developed there. A bunch of us were also film fans, and we get together, triple features and stuff like that. So it's always been a part. I'm also a very avid reader. And so one of the subjects that's always interested me has been film, film criticism, the behind the scenes, how we made this film and the technical aspects. So I've studied it for a long, long, for years. But I'd never attempted the process. Eventually, I thought, you know, the days aren't getting any longer. And so finally, I decided, you know what? I'm going to jump right in the deep end. Bought a camera. And from there, the whole process began. We completed one short film last year that I wrote that went through many changes, rewriting. We started on it. The first film we started in September of 2010, and it was a complete learning curve. The quick pitch was Cheers meets Dumb and Dumber.
Okay.
It was about a group of people sitting around a bar and some of the funny things that come up, things that I've seen.
Yes,
over the years.
From your firsthand observation.
Right. And it was a comedy. It was kind of a light comedy. Well, I realized right away that there were about 12 people in the cast of that screenplay, which was impossible. So that story was rewritten and rewritten and rewritten until it was eventually rendered down to a story called Last Call. And it was about three people. One guy that was sitting at the end of the bar that had been there all night long, the bartender. And at the very end of the night, a woman comes in to get a nightcap, and they strike up a conversation. Shot in real time. It's about a 16-minute film. We spent 3 months shooting this. I was able to get access to a cafe bar that was for sale, but was fully furnished and just sitting there. Yeah, so it was great for us because we could leave everything set up with the lighting and everything. We didn't have to tear down and move it back in. So it was a learning curve. We were learning how to run the camera. We were learning how to do a film shoot. We were learning how to act. I was learning how to edit. A whole other learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to slowly kind of get on top of the situation. By the time we finished that film in December of last year, I had written the second story.
Now, wait a minute. Back up a minute. 3 months shooting a 16-minute film, mm-hmm, and figuring out what you're doing as you go along.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever discouraged?
Plenty of times.
Did you ever think this was a dumb idea?
Every moment. You're going to tell yourself that you can't do this. Forget about that. Just keep pushing.
For 35 years, you've been performing. You've been being creative, not just with your music, but with your life, making this life work.
Hopefully.
What do you get out of obsessing over a film that you weren't getting out of music?
That's a darn good question. It's a very challenging process. But there's two things about it that I find particularly appealing. One is that it's a group project. You have to have a company of people in front of the camera, behind the camera, people who are working with you. So it's the group. You know, it's very gratifying, and those are diverse people sometimes. You know, you've got an actress who's a desk clerk at the hotel. You know, you got a guy helping you behind the camera who's a retired, you know, chemist from DuPont. You know, so it's like that. It's like a community choir or something. You've got all these people from these different walks of life who've come together to help do this. Logistically, sometimes that can make it much more difficult. And so that is rewarding but challenging. The other thing, and this was something like a bolt of lightning that struck me, there are hundreds of hours involved in editing. Once you begin the process, once you load that film onto the computer, it's on. Don't start that unless you've got 5 or 6 hours to sit there and do the audio adjustment and drop the sound effects in and cut it this way and shorten this scene. So there's hours and hours in the middle of the night of sitting there in a darkened room and at the computer screen working under the headphones. And when we were working on this new film, suddenly it struck me at 4 o'clock in the morning, here are these people, and I'm watching them reading these lines that I wrote clumsily, and I'm a completely untrained writer. But all of a sudden, I thought, here are my friends. I'm seeing the manifestation of some lame-brained idea that I had months ago. I'm cutting this scene together, and it's actually there with a soundtrack, and you know that we've determined what somebody was going to be wearing, and so that's an amazing thing. It's a very creative process.
And satisfying.
Very rewarding.
You got 3 films in the can.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other two?
Well, the first one was Last Call. When we finished that one, I'd already written a second story. The second film was an exterior location. We shot it at Thornrose Cemetery. It's a ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
We shot it at Thornrose Cemetery. It's called A Visit from Annie.
Where's Thornrose?
In Stanton, Virginia.
Stanton, okay.
A beautiful old Victorian-era cemetery, very cinematic. And I had an idea of a woman who goes to place flowers on the grave of an ancestor, and she has an unusual
experience
while she's there. And so this was a daytime shoot outside with no power source. We had to do it all battery-powered. So there was a driving sequence where we've seen them where the camera's in the car with
yes.
the person. She drives to the cemetery. So there were a couple of things I thought, let's do this.
Try it.
Because we didn't do it on the last one. And as we move through these projects, eventually we're going to get to now. We got to do a driving sequence here. How do we do it? Oh, yeah, we did that on the, you know, now we know. And so that one was done. The first one took us 3.5 months to shoot. A Visit from Annie was 2 weeks to shoot. So when we began the first film, we knew nothing. We began the second film, we knew nothing, plus maybe a thing or two.
You knew a thing or two.
Just a little bit. So then I got really emboldened. I got ambitious. I thought, okay, I think we're ready for a real challenge now. So the film that we're about to wrap, when we finished Annie in February, I began writing this story called Family in the Old Country. It's a longer film. It's an hour feature. It's got 7 people in the cast. It's a story about human loss. It's a story of a woman, she's a Polish refugee from the Second World War, who comes to America. She's lost her entire family in the Holocaust, and she's lived in her late uncle's home in New Jersey for 25 years. So it's now 1970. She's alone, no friends, no family. A young, divorced, single dad and his high school-age son move in next door. And this guy decides that he wants to be friends with this little lady who lives next door. She resists his efforts at friendship. He refuses to accept that. So he keeps working at it. Finally, they become friends. Story comes out that his own father was killed in action in the Second World War fighting with American forces in France. And he's never been to visit his father's grave, which is in a little French cemetery where this battle, little skirmish took place.
Mm-hmm.
So in the third act of the film, he finally suggests, I've reached a point in my life where I have to go to France and find my dad's grave, and I'd like for you to come with us. And so she very reluctantly agrees to go back to the old country with her new
family,
found family.
Yep.
And there's a breakthrough that happens there. All of a sudden, the dots start to connect, that everybody in every aspect of this conflict lost people that they loved.
Now, you have invested whole lot of time, I would bet a fair amount of money.
Considerably.
Are you ever going to earn anything with is or is this love?
The short-term goal right now is to simply keep filming and keep working on and doing this. But I guess a slightly longer-range goal would be to somehow become known as a person who does this. I'm convinced that opportunity will present itself, not necessarily economic reward, but if I step into that network, I'm going to meet people. They're going to meet me. They're going to see my work. I'm going to see what other people are doing. I'm going to become known as a person who makes films at whatever level. And I'm convinced that then the opportunities will start to present themselves that I haven't even dreamt of.
You know, I've been around you for 35 years, and, you know, we weren't babies at the beginning of it. And you seem ageless to me in that there's absolutely no, but it's not just in appearance, it's in attitude that you see infinite possibilities for sort of reinventing yourself that sort of stretch on into the towards the horizon. Am I right about that?
Well, you're very kind. I like to think that I remain that the glass is half full, you know, rather than half empty. It's difficult sometimes to think that way, you know, when you're young and you're eager and you're fresh out of the gate and you don't know any better, you know, sometimes you just, you're full of so much enthusiasm that you just kind of like, blunder your way through life and let the chips fall where they may. And there's something very beautiful and magical about being at that point in life. But you make a lot of dumb mistakes and you learn, you know, through trial and error. When you're older, I think some of that youthful vim and vigor has dissipated a little bit, but it's tempered by the fact that now you've learned a thing or two.
Yeah.
And you can do things in a more structured, more efficient manner.
A more focused way.
Exactly. And so perhaps you still have to dig a little deeper into that reservoir of motivation and determination, but you can do it in a much more reasonable and lower impact way to yourself and others around you simply because you've been around the block a few times. You know, you reach that point where you've invested so much time and energy and money that it's too late to turn back now. You know, I've got to keep doing this because I can't write all this off. So anyway, there's a bit of that going on.
Are you still Jimmy O when you're a director, or are you James Overton?
James Overton is the director, and the music is by Jimmy O. So that way I get to, I don't know, I don't have to pay myself or something.
Jimmy O / James Overton, this has been a treat.
It's been a lot of fun, Martha. Thank you so much for having me.